The National Convention today is brought to every home in the United States by television. And now, even more significant, by Early Bird and Telstar, those pictures are going to nations all over the civilized world. Now, what do we see? We've seen a picture of confusion, of noise, of impossible deportment, of indifference toward the subjects that are being discussed from the platform, and in short, a thing that if it happened into a business trustee meeting, you'd be horrified. Well, I think the most of the United States is horrified by what it sees about these conventions.
This is Second Sunday, picking a president. Somehow it works. Here is Robert McCormick, NBC News.
The blistering warning that former President Eisenhower gave the Republican National Committee at a luncheon in Washington more than 3 years ago was for him both harsh and emphatic, but it was milk and honey compared to what was to come from others after the Miami Beach and Chicago conventions this year, when the uneasiness, the distrust, the frustration, the anger of large portions of the citizenry exploded through television and radio in the homes of millions of Americans. The 1960s have been called the era of revolution, and what we saw and heard in August was more of the same social and political revolution that manifested itself so far this decade in three horrible assassinations, in bloody disturbances in almost every major city, and in the almost savage dissatisfaction shown by a sizable minority of our young people against the vaguely defined establishment that produced and educated these same young people and gave them the freedom to attack the social organization that they now say they'd like to destroy, but which presumably they will be obliged to help operate within the next few years. In any event, the conventions, through circumstance and through the careful planning of the more militant establishment haters, became a focal point for the nation's unhappiness with its social structure, its economic structure, and particularly its political structure. And the conventions were condemned as the cause of the unhappiness rather than as the symbol. Yet some of our most distinguished students of political science think conventions are maligned, and such a person is Professor James McGregor Burns of Williams College.
I don't agree with people who say that the two conventions this year were fiascos or that just the Democratic convention was a fiasco. The fiasco was Chicago. It turned out to be a very bad site for a convention, although it's also true that no matter where the Democrats held their convention this year, there would have been a group of people, not all the young people there certainly, but a group who were determined to disrupt the convention city. The Democratic convention itself was a great success, I would argue, because it indicated that even under the pressure of that city, under the pressure of police overreaction and all the rest of what happened in Chicago, a convention could be held where the issues were debated, where Vietnam in particular received a very intelligent and effective discussion, where the convention system itself was reformed and improved, and where despite some incidents on the floor, the convention was able to be held in a perfectly effective manner. And the Republican convention has been criticized for perhaps not meeting some of the issues, but I think the Republicans too conducted a pretty effective convention. Even if there were some failures in Chicago in 1968, I wouldn't want to condemn a convention system that has operated effectively now for 130 years on the basis of what some would consider to be a failing of one particular convention.
Many other renowned students, both in the academic world and in politics, agree with Burns. For example, Dr. Herbert McCluskey, professor of political science and a research psychologist at the University of California at Berkeley, who would, however, make some changes that he thinks would be improvements.
there needs to be some kind of proportional system of representation in the state, so that if there is a division in a state primary or a division in the convention, that both camps get some degree of representation. Also, there were reforms, of course, built around the serious deprivation that minorities, especially blacks, suffered. That has now may have been very significantly altered by the Democrats at Chicago. I take it there will be a time when ethnic discrimination in the selection of delegates will be largely eliminated. I would also cut down the number and length of speeches and demonstrations. This too was done at, by the Democrats at Chicago. I think, by the way, we could point out here that while the Chicago thing drew a lot of attention for reasons that were most unfortunate, some of the very great advances that were made in party reform, such as those I just mentioned, ought not to be overlooked. I suppose if I had to make some other reforms, I would make the delegations smaller. I would reduce the size of the convention to more manageable proportions so that there wouldn't be quite the same degree of chaos. They would be more capable of discussing and reflecting on some of the important questions that face them.
But grumpy demands that conventions be abolished become more persistent, along with demands that they be replaced by primary elections in which the voters themselves would pick the candidates they like best in their respective parties. Senator Birch Bayh, the Indiana Democrat, heads a congressional subcommittee that has made perhaps the most exhaustive effort so far to get the pros and cons laid down by the highest possible caliber witnesses. Their views, all sincere but often contradictory, have moved Bayh to devote many hours to weighing the arguments.
As I see it, we have two alternatives available. One is to create a nationwide presidential primary. The second would be to democratize the convention system as it now is generally structured. We really don't have enough evidence, and there hasn't been enough study directed at the impact of the nationwide primary. There are two obvious hurdles that I think we need to anticipate and see if they can be alleviated. Unless they can, I think the nationwide primary, although it sounds good, would be less desirable in strengthening and democratizing the convention system. These two hurdles are, one, how are you going to finance the nationwide primary? Unless there is some way to deal with this problem, you're going to have to say that a person is going to have tremendous independent wealth or the availability of other people's money, or you just can't afford to conduct a primary in 50 different states across this great land of ours. The second problem is I'm a bit concerned about how a nationwide primary might proliferate the two-party system and tend to weaken our two political parties. The convention system, with all its weaknesses, has tended to keep the two-party system functioning by giving each party the chance in the convention to keep its base as broad as is possible within the general principles of the party, so that it has as much support in the electorate as is possible. And I'd hate to see us get into a situation like the last French Republic, where they had so many different parties and the election power was so diverse and, throughout the electorate that you really had instability like you just can't afford to have in a modern-day democracy or representative form of government. One thing that's been overlooked that I think was a significant step that was taken in the last Democratic Convention, among all of the other things that happened at Chicago, there's been all too little attention given to the fact that the convention did adopt the minority report on revision of the Democratic Convention in 1972. We said that as of 1972, all of the delegates to the Democratic Convention will be either elected at a statewide primary in each of the states or by conventions in the states to which the delegates have been chosen by primary vote of the people of the party within the state. Now this, in effect, goes a long way toward making the national primary system more just.
Senator By knows that the sinister jeering that is now directed at conventions may in 1 month be re-aimed at the Electoral College if the strength of third-party candidate George Wallace makes the Electoral College impotent and throws the selection of a president into the House of Representatives, where each state will have only one vote and which could produce a president that a majority of people don't want and didn't vote for.
The irony of this is that until recently, when there's been a great deal more notoriety put upon this shortcoming in our Constitution, most people were blindly going along, going into that election booth year after year under the false impression that they were voting for president, when in actuality they weren't. They were voting for a group of electors, faceless, nameless individuals, and really weren't aware of the fact that these men were the ones that made the final decision and that the individual voter really didn't have a voice in the final choice as to who the top officer in the land would be.
We ask Senator By to elaborate on his misgivings about the mischief that might be caused by Wallace and his vaporous third party.
Well, I'm extremely concerned about the present Electoral College system. For several reasons. The first of which, and the most apparent, is the presence of this elector, or these electors, that have independent choice. They are not bound in most cases, and not at all by the United States Constitution, to support the candidate that carries their state. We have the rather interesting phenomena of 1960 of Mr. Nixon carrying the state of Oklahoma. The Republican electors then in December went to Oklahoma City, and one of these Republican electors cast his vote for Harry Byrd, a Democratic senator who wasn't even a candidate. We had that same thing that's happened several times in the past, and the thing that makes this particularly dangerous now is when we look at the Wallace vote, I think we need to recognize that George Wallace is going to get a significant block of electors.
Senator By suggested we talk to two men considered among the country's top experts in the history, philosophy, and perhaps most important, the mechanics of our political system. Dr. Evren Kirkpatrick, Executive Director of the American Political Science Association, and Richard Scammon, Director of the Elections Research Center. Kirkpatrick started, and I just let him go.
Well, it's always possible that no candidate get a majority in the Electoral College. Some people speculate that that will be the case in 1968, and that Wallace will get enough votes to prevent either Nixon or Humphrey from getting a majority. If that's the case, all kinds of problems arise. Will the election really go to the House of Representatives? Will Wallace get his electors together and come to a decision that they'll cast their votes either for Humphrey or Nixon and never get it into the House of Representatives but have George Wallace named the next President of the United States?
Well, suppose it does get into the House, Mr. Scammon. What happens then?
Well, you have a number of problems even there because there are some procedural questions relating to how the House would conduct this kind of operation. It's been over a century since we had this happen, and of course it happened under a political set of circumstances far different than those we know in modern America. I think it would be generally agreed by political scientists that if this were to happen, it would be a very messy business. I'm not quite sure. You'd have to operate in a circumstance in which members of the House would be making a variety of judgments. They would be making judgments, among other things, depending on how they thought the Senate might act in picking a vice president-elect who could become acting president if they fail to act. And it's just this kind of complexity that one can multiply and multiply and multiply almost endlessly.
Well, suppose members of the House didn't like any of the presidential candidates, or at least he couldn't get a majority. By the way, would a man need a majority in the House to become president?
Yes, he must have 26 states. In other words, each state has one vote in the House, and the person to be elected as president by the House must have a clear constitutional majority of the states, 26, that is, not counting the District of Columbia.
But it's terribly possible that he might not get a majority.
Yes, because not only is there the problem of having the three candidates, because the Constitution provides that the House shall choose amongst the top three, but there are a certain number of states that we might presume will be deadlocked in the sense of two Republicans and two Democrats from a state like Oregon. And this state cannot have its vote counted. However, this does not diminish the requirement that you have 26 states, a constitutional majority of the 50, in order to be elected.
Suppose a sufficient number of members of the House don't want any one of the three men to be president that they have a chance to vote on, and deliberately withhold their votes, so it will be up to whomever the Senate selects as a vice president. Can't the Senate get into the same jam or that sort of thing?
Well, they could get into it in the sense that it requires, again, 51 votes in the Senate to elect. And the situation is not quite the same as in the House in that they pick from the two highest. And so there's certainly a very good possibility that somebody would get the 51. But it's certainly possible that that might not happen if you had some states absent entirely, or people absented themselves because they didn't want to participate in the choice. You can conceive of a situation in which each candidate might get 40 votes.
I think one ought, though, to interject and point out that these are all sort of horrible examples of what might happen. But I think we also must say that the greatest likelihood is that there is going to be a clear decision on November 5th, as far as the electors are concerned, that the next likelihood is that if there is not a clear decision on November 5th, that when the electors meet, some judgment will be made by the third candidate with respect to the top two as to which way they're going, and that the third likelihood is that the House will make a judgment. Now, you could, of course, and Dr. Kirkpatrick is quite correct, that there are possibilities and happenings that could develop out of this thing that get almost like a science fiction story.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It's very easy to pose all of the horrible kinds of things that might happen, but the fact is that in election after election, somebody has gotten a majority of the electoral vote, and that's likely to be the case in the future. And I think that's likely to be the case in 1968.
And this happened, of course, in 1912, when we had our most recent major threat. We did have a threat in 1924 with Mr. La Follette's candidacy, but in 1912, when President Wilson was elected with 42% of the popular vote, he did get a clear majority in the Electoral College without difficulty. On the other hand, it's equally true that sometimes somebody's going to steal the horse out of the barn. In other words, almost inevitably, sooner or later, the kind of thing we've been talking about is going to happen. Somebody is not going to get that clear decision on election night.
Let me pose one other hypothetical question to you. If in the House, for example, the delegations from four or five of the biggest, most populated, most populous states were divided, so their votes didn't count, we could then have a minority-minority president, couldn't we, even if the House did reach a decision?
You certainly could have.
Oh, yeah.
There's no question about that. That is, if the vote, it seems unlikely to me, but if the vote was evenly split in New York and Pennsylvania and Illinois and California, but 26 of the other states voted for a president, you could have a president representing a very small portion of the population.
If you took the 26 smallest states, they have, after all, the weight to elect a president. And
they have it even if the others aren't equally divided.
That's right.
The 26 smallest states could elect a president, even though the 24 other states, representing an overwhelming majority of the population, voted for the other candidate.
Right. Quite right.
But taking three situations that you conjured up in your imaginations, one is that it would never get into the House because the Wallace people, if they were in a position, could make a deal before the vote ever got to the House. They could make a deal in the Electoral College to throw their votes to one man or the other.
Well, if I may interrupt there, I wouldn't say make a deal. I think that this kind of a deal would be almost impossible to do. Our political life is so public, I just don't think this would happen. They might make a judgment as to which of the two other candidates was the preferable or the least objectionable, whichever way you want to put it.
Well, in 1968, Scammon, you have a good case in point. Let's assume that Wallace does hold the balance of power. It'd make a very interesting thing for him to call together his electors and spend three or four days consulting with them about who they would vote for of the two other candidates. They'd get full publicity from the papers and from television, and Wallace could talk about
saving the country. I can imagine every hotel room in Montgomery would be gone to the next.
That's right. Saving the country from a constitutional crisis.
Yes, indeed.
could demonstrate that he was a responsible citizen, right, just waiting for 1972.
Yep. This is certainly possible, and then might make a judgment to support, say, Mr. Nixon or Mr. Humphrey. And I think a decision on that, of that kind would probably be greeted with great relief. People would think that the crisis had been averted, which indeed it had been, but this would still lead us back to the possibility that this could happen again. And it is true under our present system that there is this possibility, especially if we're going to be faced in the not-too-distant future with more than two candidates as a normal kind of pattern.
Kirkpatrick and Scammon shared the belief that there are real and potential dangers in the present system of selecting presidents, but that there might be even greater hazards in a substitute system. Now, this same concern, that if we abruptly junk what we have and impulsively move to a new system, we might go from bad to worse, has bothered Senator Gaylord Nelson, the Wisconsin Democrat. He has proposed to Congress a plan for deciding, first, whether we should change our present method, and second, what we should put in its place.
I have inclined to the viewpoint that it would probably be better not to have the Electoral College and to have the candidate who got the most votes become the president, assuming he had a certain percentage of the total, 40% or 45% or something like that. I think we need a national commission to carefully evaluate the whole presidential primary system and the whole convention system, and to air and discuss and evaluate all the problems involved, because you might very well jump into a brand new system that doesn't work half as well as the one we've got. I think it's healthy to air the question. And I think if we had a commission that was representative with presidential appointees, representatives of Congress, representatives of the candidates for the presidency, for the nomination, and representatives of the cities and states, and had a good analysis and hearings, discussions over a period of a year, that they could, get some public education about what the problem's about and better understanding of what the problem is, and hopefully come up with some useful, constructive suggestions that will have public confidence and assure fair and equitable and democratic selection of the presidential nominees.
Senator Nelson at least has a plan. It doesn't promise fast action, but does presumably guarantee a safe approach, as safe as any approach to such a bewildering problem can possibly be. At this point, we know that political conventions are blamed for many of the things that the more restless citizens think are wrong with this country. We have an indication that the weird electoral college system of choosing a president may finally come a cropper this year, which would shift mass hatred from conventions to the electoral college. But at the same time, we have testimony that if we scrap our present system and adopt another without adequate study, we may wind up with something considerably worse than we have now. Well, in the middle of this turmoil stands television. Through some mysterious transference, television has been accused of wrecking our traditional patterns of political behavior by exposing those patterns to the world at large. Well, one of the outstanding men who's taken a critical position on television is Newton Minow, former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, now a lawyer in private practice in Chicago, and a delegate from Illinois to the Democratic Convention. Mr. Minow, is there a real danger in the possibility that the public watching and hearing conventions will believe everything it sees and hears, although some of what it sees and hears might be out of perspective or even perhaps downright untrue?
There's always that danger. That danger is not limited to conventions. I think the real point is that what you see really happens. The question is, what is it that you don't see? Have you seen the whole picture, or have you gotten a broad perspective on it, or have you got an isolated instance? And here, in the last analysis, I think we have to trust to the basic fairness and journalistic judgment of the people who are doing our broadcasting.
Newton Minow then was asked whether television could perhaps encourage the idea of psychological packaging of candidates, putting them in fancy wrappers and selling them to the public without bothering to go into the question of whether they're really any good.
Yes, there is. I think that with modern techniques of advertising and selling being applied to politics, there is this danger. On the other hand, I think the best antidote or remedy to that would be to have face-to-face confrontations and debates between the candidates, because at that point, a candidate is on his own, and I think the public would benefit greatly by seeing the candidates under the cross-examination, under the questioning of their opponents, and to be forced then to make a decision based on each man's performance, rather than any kind of prepackaged performance given to him by his advisors.
In quick succession, Minow was then asked a series of questions. First, does he think television coverage has a significant impact on voters?
I think television, in many ways, has become the most important part of the, particularly in presidential politics, most important part of influencing voters. I think it's no longer true that a voter can be influenced as much by a political organization or a precinct captain urging him to vote a certain way when he has direct access to the candidate via television. And I think this is one of the major changes in presidential politics caused by television.
And a look into the future, what does Minow think about the idea of equipping television sets with buttons or something so listeners can express their reactions to political candidates and political questions immediately?
I think this is very likely, and I would think sometime during the next decade, during the 1970s, this will occur with the rapid growth of cable television technology, the rapid growth of computer technology. I would foresee the day when everyone in his home will be able to talk back to his television set, or perhaps through his television set, into a central place where his opinion can be tabulated very quickly. And I would think we may end up, even with a very large country of hundreds of millions of people, having access, at least if it wants it, to a pure democratic process.
Would this be desirable?
I think it would be very helpful. I think one of the big problems we have in our increasingly complex society is the feeling that many people have, particularly our young people, that they have nothing to say, that they can't participate, that their views don't count. And I think if we had a mechanism through which we could express our views quickly and be sure they were counted fairly, it would be a helpful thing. I think it would give people new heart, new hope in the democratic process.
While Newton Minow's theories about selling candidates the way one might sell soap or prunes or spaghetti got us around to a man who is, by reputation, an expert in presenting candidates to the voters as gifts from on high. His name is Bill Roberts. He's a partner in Spencer Roberts Associates, a firm perhaps best described as devoted to political campaign management. We wanted to know particularly whether Bill Roberts could take just any old slob named Joe Tinklefern and make him into a serious contender for elective office.
Yes, we can. While money isn't everything, it is one of the major ingredients in getting name identification and getting your story across. In this era of a preoccupied public with social and recreation and job responsibilities and families, and with the great number of the electorate you're talking to, you do need a great deal of money to get through to them. That's the old adage of you tell them and tell them and tell them, and then pretty soon they say, "What? You said something?" And so we try to operate on that theory in a race of continually telling people a particular story. And we have on many occasions taken a very unknown candidate with an adequate financing and a good campaign and elected them. I don't say we alone because it involves great numbers of volunteers and so forth, but it can be done. I'm sure there's probably an election or two in the country today that's still being bought, so to speak, because they have more money than their opponents.
Well, since Mr. Roberts was so frank, we decided to ask what he considers the basic rules for managing a successful campaign.
Two of the important ones would be dealing from a position of strength. As an example, if you were in the Reagan campaign in 1966, Governor Reagan was very strong in Southern California and much weaker in Northern California, both during the primary and the general election, and therefore we concentrated a great deal of his scheduled time in Southern California. We did not fall for the usual naive approach of going away from our position of strength and trying to strengthen up our weak areas. We weren't looking for a mandate. We find that where there are votes, if you work hard, there are a lot more votes. The voters of the opposite party in a given area are more amenable in your strong areas to going for you than they are in your weak areas. And so it just makes good sense, we found, to stay with that. Secondly, we dance to our own tune in a campaign. That is to say, we don't let the opposition, certainly, and we don't let, frankly, the opinion makers of the community, either television or newspapers or anyone else, tell us what we should be campaigning on as far as issues and so forth. We set our own tone. We certainly listen to what they have to say, but we do not necessarily incorporate it in our campaign. A good example of that, again, in 66, Governor Reagan was continually asked that he must deal with the problem of extremism and the John Birch Society in his campaign. We didn't feel it was an issue, and so we decided not to join it, even though we were pressured continuously, not only by our opposition, but by respected newspapers and so forth, to do so.
In view of this pragmatic approach to what has in the past been represented as an idealistic undertaking, choosing men for high office, does Mr. Roberts think the system we have now is good?
By and large, I think our system works excellently. It has had some breakdowns of late in communication and in being viable enough to be accepted by a lot of the young people and by certain of our minority groups. But I think with some adjustments in the system, with some changes to bring it up to the 20th and 21st centuries, that this system has already shown the world that it's what it can do in the way of physical and materialistic advancement. And I think the system is worth giving a good long look at and fighting to improve and keep.
Mr. Roberts' practical, psychological, computerized approach to politics is a long hoot and holler from the old days when the mark of a successful practitioner of the art was a swallow-tailed coat, a great shock of undulating white hair, a plug of chewing tobacco, and a head full of Cracker Barrel jokes. Well, politics have moved frightfully fast in the last 50 years. For example, the first talking film of a presidential candidate was made in 1924 of Wisconsin Senator Robert La Follette running as a third-party candidate as a progressive, and ironically, Calvin Coolidge, the sour-faced little president who won international recognition as the man who hated to say anything. And in that same year, a few people with crystal sets heard the first radio broadcast of a political convention spread from Boston to Kansas City. Well, thanks to this breathtaking technological breakthrough by NBC, the nation was treated to the monotonous chant of 24 votes for Underwood as the Democrats sweated through 103 ballots to pick a candidate. And just 4 years later, the country was privileged to hear the historic speech by Franklin Roosevelt nominating New York Governor Al Smith for the presidency.
We offer one who has the will to win, who not only deserves success, but commands it. Victory is his habit. The happy warrior, Alfred E. Smith.
Al Smith kept the audience with his acceptance speech.
Now let's look at the record. Prohibition has found a new line of endeavor for the underworld. They brought life to the bootleggers, and the bootleggers begot the hijackers, and the hijackers begot the racketeers. My friends of the radio audience, the only cure for the ills of democracy is more democracy.
Al Smith's sponsor, Franklin Roosevelt, brought the airplane into big-time politics in 1932 by flying to Chicago to accept the Democratic Convention's presidential nomination. Roosevelt's bravery made a deep impression, but it's interesting to note, parenthetically, that from that day on, he flew only when he had to. But theoretically, the first television broadcast connected with politics was made in 1932 and was done by CBS. But the first convention coverage was done by NBC in 1940. But because of World War II and the inevitable slowdown in technological development, it didn't become a habit until 1948. And even that coverage, in which I participated as an economy-sized version of a combined Huntley-Brinkley, was little more than a defiant gesture on the part of a cocky but runty industry. What has happened in the succeeding 20 years is history, but history that is still being made. And we are moving more rapidly every day, with results that are not always good. Our speed of development is one reason for the upheavals that have marked the revolution of the 60s, again, in the opinion of Dr. McCluskey at the University of California at Berkeley.
Some of the difficulties that we've had in the last few years, I think, are traceable precisely to the great advances that have been made among minorities and in the changes in the standard of living, a greater democratization throughout the society, and so on. And while all these things are to be praised from the point of view of anyone who believes in democracy and liberal politics, it also produces reactions in the society, and some people are discomfited or made uneasy by the uncertainties which are generated by this kind of rapid change.
Simple explanations of what's wrong and what remedies should be tried are considered by a substantial number of our more vocal young people as the Pollyannish simperings of those who can see right through the darkest cloud to the inevitable silver lining. To thousands of articulate, well-educated, thoughtful, although perhaps destructive, youth, this country is run by squares who don't see it as it is. One spokesman for what has come to be known as the new left in politics is Rennie Davis, 27 years old, one of the organizers of the demonstrations at the Chicago Convention. Whether you agree or not, whether you are a square, a round, or an isosceles triangle, you should listen, because Rennie Davis speaks not only for himself, but for a great many other people.
I think that there is, in other words, a broad cross-section of people who believe that, that we are capable of more, and are testing various ways in which this country could achieve its potential. We have again and again, though, I think, found the institutions unresponsive to new direction. 5 years ago in this city, some 250,000 people marched on Washington for jobs and freedom. And that was a time when it was sunny and nice, and people petitioned their government, and President Kennedy came out with a smile and welcomed the leaders and so on and so forth. But during those 5 years, no substantial progress was made with respect to the issues that they raised. In fact, three times as much money in those 5 years was spent on the war against black people, the war that develops riot control weaponry technique, than was spent on the war on poverty. In those 5 years, some 500,000 people, Americans, were sent to Southeast Asia. In those 5 years, we dropped more bombs on Vietnam than we dropped in the entire period of World War II. And 5 years later, in Chicago, when the central issue facing this election period was attempted to be raised in a legal and constitutional way at the Democratic Convention, those people seeking to raise that issue were clubbed and beaten and gassed in front of the Conrad Hilton. So I think that people are looking for ways to establish their hopes and their visions in this country. And for many, it means going outside established institutions. It means establishing the kind of free universities where the kind of education we think matters to people could be done. It means beginning to build our own communities in this country. It means challenging directly the illegitimate and unrepresentative authority. It means confronting more aggressively policies of genocide in Vietnam. It means everywhere denouncing authority militantly and defiantly, which we feel continues its racist character in the black communities.
Rennie Davis represents what could perhaps best be considered an extremist position, working toward much the same goals, but working within the establishment more or less, is Julian Bond, a soft-spoken, handsome, practical politician who became the first Negro to be elected to the Georgia legislature and who for a time was refused his seat. Bond spoke last week at the Babson Institute at Wellesley, Massachusetts. Bond was asked what he would have done had he been in Mayor Daley's place during the Chicago convention.
Well, if I were Mayor Daley, I'd handle him the same way he did. if I were me, first, I think I would have given him a permit to use the streets for the purpose of demonstrations. I mean, American Legionnaires come to Chicago and commit obscenities in hotels and out in the streets, and other groups do. And here's a group of people who simply wanted to be able to walk and or march down the street and hold rallies, and I see no reason why they should not have been allowed to do so.
Well, how does Julian Bond interpret or define the campaign's most publicized catchphrase, law and order?
When George Wallace says law and order, what he means is that if you lie down in front of his automobile, he will run over you. When Richard Nixon says law and order, what he means is that if you lie down in front of his automobile, he will order his chauffeur to run over you. And when Hubert Humphrey says law and order, what he means is that when Mr. Nixon and Mr. Wallace are running over you, he will cry.
From his unique position as an educated, successful Negro politician in the South, Julian Bond indulged in a bit of mellow, eloquent philosophizing.
There is in this nation an obvious longing for change, and that longing is shared not just by black people in the cities, but by students on the campuses and by housewives in their kitchens, and doctors and lawyers and teachers and cab drivers and dime store clerks and people all over this country. The job of those interested in change is to put those groups of people and their longing together. I can remember when Robert Kennedy announced his candidacy for the presidency of the United States. Some of us cringed. He's ruthless, we said. Or he was a bad attorney general, we said. Or it's a plot by President Johnson, we said. But no one who saw black people in Watts scrambling to touch his hand or who saw white farmers in Alabama laughing at his jokes could believe that for long. And no one who saw the miles and miles of mourners who followed his funeral train from New York to Washington could remember old tales or harbor old grudges. When Eugene McCarthy, months before Kennedy, announced his candidacy, we said it's only a trick. We said he just wants to get us off the streets and into the system. We said he just wants to kill the student movement. But no one who saw the students in New Hampshire could believe that student movements in America are dead. And no one who saw the Battle of the Conrad Hilton can believe that McCarthy got the students off the street. Those two campaigns, with all of their failures and their tragic losses, brought something special to this country. That something special was the fervor and the feeling that had not existed in this nation since the Freedom Rides of 1961, that had not existed in this nation since the March on Washington in 1963.
Well, Julian Bond summed up a good bit of what we and the others in this program have been trying to say. It would seem fair to draw these conclusions. Our system of selecting presidents is hateful to many people, especially younger people, who consider it undemocratic and unfair. There is a strong and constantly getting stronger feeling that conventions should be abolished along with the Electoral College that was obsolete within a few years after it was set up under our Constitution. But it might be better to try to improve the system we have now rather than wipe it out altogether. But if elimination of conventions and the Electoral College is finally chosen as the proper course, we should study with extreme care the alternatives, because any one of them is potentially at least as bad, at least as subject to fatal flaws as the system we have now. If you are confused and disturbed, that's probably good, because it could be the beginning of action, and perhaps Senator Nelson's idea is best. Get the finest brains in the country together, let them hear all sides and all angles of all sides, and come up with recommendations that might, with a little luck, be workable.
I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help me God.
I, Harry S. Truman, do solemnly swear.
I, Dwight D. Eisenhower, do solemnly swear.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
I, Lyndon Baines Johnson, do solemnly swear.
This is Robert McCormick, NBC News.
Second Sunday, Picking a President. Somehow It Works. Was produced by James Quigley. Directed by Edward Smith. Tape editing by William Tuohy. Reporters included Robert Abernethy, Bob Lazich, Jim Ruddle, Linda Sutter, and Gene Slaymaker. Your announcer is Jerry Damon. This Second Sunday program was a presentation of NBC News.